Now, as I said before, the theme of mental disturbance in Blue Orange is reminiscent of your first play, Some Voices. Could we go back in time a bit and talk about why you started to write plays in the first place?
I think because, I mean, there's obvious reasons, which is just that, you know, I was exposed to plays by Arthur Miller and Harold Pinter and Joe Orme that just sort of excited me. But I think probably the deeper reason, the more abiding reason, the reason why that I've kept at it and kept doing it is because theatre is about behaviour. At its best, it's about people on stage doing things, saying things, reacting to things, disseminating ideas. It's about behaviour, and I'm fascinated by behaviour, you know. And I have ideas when I think, would this make a good film, or would this make a good novel, should I have a go at a novel, or whatever. But it strikes me that the stuff that I write about, certainly in Some Voices and Blue Orange, they are essentially about behaviour, and the theatre is the best place to see those things. You know, there's nothing more fascinating than watching somebody behaving in the way that these characters behave, you know. So they seem to be made for the theatre.
And at the time when you wrote it, I think you were working as a journalist, and I remember you saying somewhere that journalism really couldn't represent the horror of the care in the community policy and all its consequences. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true, I think. I mean, I'm wary of it sounding like I had a kind of a mission statement and an axe to grind, and so I rushed to the most expedient form that I could find to spread the good word, because that'd be insane. I mean, so few people go to the theatre compared to the number of people that read the papers. But I can remember just thinking at the time when I was writing those stories, it's just so easy for the editor to go, look, I'm sick of your endless homelessness stories, or I'm sick of your endless care in the community stories. Spike it. Let's have the story on, you know, I don't know, the pantomime at Richmond, you know. So, and likewise, it's just very easy for people to turn the page as well when it's in a paper and just turn to page 3 or whatever. So it struck me that a theatre, you've got this kind of captive audience and they lock the doors and you don't let them out until they've lived through the thing you want them to live through. And it's there, it's in 3D, it's inescapable. It's a great way of, if you've got something to say, a theatre's a good place to say it, because, you know, it's hard to ignore. Likewise, if you do a bad play or you're writing about something that's unpalatable and horrific to watch, then theatre's ghastly, you know, because you are a captive audience. You're right there and it's live, you know, with real people doing it.
Some Voices, obviously it's about two brothers, Ray and Pete. Can you say a bit about their relationship?
Yeah, I mean, Some Voices was my attempt to write True West by Sam Shepard, you know. Just as I'm sure Martin McDonagh will tell you that he's rewritten True West in The Lonesome West or whatever, and just about all the playwrights of my generation have done their nicking from Sam, and their nicking from Mamet, and their nicking from Pinter, and all the guys anyway. So it was partly that, and it was partly, you know, I suppose I loved True West because it was about the good brother and the bad brother. It was about the articulate, silver-tongued smoothie who made a go of his life, and it was about the badass, you know, who kind of went to the bad and ended up living as trailer trash and, you know, with a kind of alcohol problem. And I think that we love those kind of characters, because there's a bad boy in everybody. And and also it was about me and my brother, you know, who's a good bloke, you know, he's a good chap, and he went to university and he's been working since he was 21, and he's got kids and he's always had a mortgage, and he's a fascinating guy and a really funny, interesting guy, but he's also a decent bloke that's never really kind of been interested in the dark side or the wild side of the tracks. Whereas for some reason I kind of instantly, gleefully sort of gravitated towards the most sort of ridiculous situations and dangerous situations I could find, and you know, kind of exhumed whatever darkness and badness I could find, really. It interested me, I don't know why, you know. And all the people I knew were like that, you know, drinking and getting in fights and sort of not really particularly, you know, they were kind of fringe dwellers. And, you know, you go through that phase, everybody goes through that phase probably. And then you come out and you think, well, that was pretty funny, really. You know, it was really funny that you got this black sheep. Every family has a black sheep, and, you know, I think that they're interesting. But so that's the autobiographical side. You know, it's just, it's pure fun. You know, the two sides of a similar nature. But again, this friend of mine who was schizophrenic, he had a brother, and they had a very similar relationship to Ray and Pete in the play. And this brother, this poor brother, he's had to sort of go through his hell with him to keep him on the straight and narrow.
And also, one of the themes in your work, especially with Love and Understanding, the character of Richie, the wild man, at the centre of that, and obviously in Some Voices, is that perhaps the idea of normality, of working hard, has been a bit undervalued in British theatrical culture, where, you know, mainly plays which deal with heroin or drugs or violence or in-your-face confrontation are valued more highly than this kind of...
It was a brief period, it didn't last very long, but there was a brief period when there was lots of plays that were about kind of mutilation and you know, injecting heroin into your eyeballs and stuff like that. And I, for some reason, had this mad idea that it would be really cool to write a play about a really dull guy who lived in Putney with his girlfriend and sort of paid the mortgage and did a 9-to-5 job and was pretty responsible, you know. I thought that would be really rock and roll. And so I did that play. And again, you know, to a certain extent it was autobiographical. It was kind of the warring halves of me. And to a certain extent it was about friends of mine, you know, who... Now that I was relatively established as a playwright and had a fairly settled life, I did have these friends from the past drifting back into my life and inevitably kind of eating me out of house and home and taking all my money and getting drunk and attempting to fornicate with my girlfriend. So there was that autobiographical element. But also at the time I did think you can... I was interested in films by people like Whit Stillman and, you know, Hal Hartley and these very literate American... sort of neo-beat filmmakers who were writing a dirty realism but about essentially quite ordinary people. You know, Raymond Carver writes dirty realism, supposedly. But if you look at his stuff, they're all people that work in bakeries or, you know, as cleaners or, you know, waitresses or whatever. They're kind of fairly ordinary people. And so I just wanted to write a play about very ordinary people, but, you know, and the ordinary people I knew were kind of like Richie and Neil and Rachel, journalists, doctors, middle-class ordinary people.
That's Love and Understanding. In Pale Horse, there's a different kind of darkness, I think, and that's death, I suppose, and bereavement. Where did that play come from?
That came from one of the first girlfriends I ever had, who had an extremely intense, passionate a relationship with. Was killed in a car crash when I was about 21. And being 21, I didn't know how to deal with it at all. And being sort of agnostic and not having any kind of faith whatsoever, I kind of just immediately sort of threw myself into this self-destructive cycle of just general sort of hell-raising and bad behavior and drinking and getting in brawls and stuff. Just like Charles in the play, really, you know. And it seemed to be license. It seemed to be like a really good excuse to be as bad as possible for about a year or so. And then, like, years later, when I was writing plays, it suddenly occurred to me one night that maybe if I had religion, then the whole thing might have been much easier to deal with. You know, is it possible that people who have a faith that I've always kind of sneered at all my life are actually the lucky ones? You know, so it was a very simple idea. It's kind of an undergraduate idea, but it enabled me to explore the things that interested me in a very existential context, you know, religion, science, medicine, titty bars, you know, you name it, it's all in there, violence, you know. And I suppose I was wondering why the people that I knew were like they were, and why I'd been like that at one stage, living the kind of existence that horrified my dad, you know, getting in brawls and getting drunk and not having proper jobs and stuff like that. How do people get like that? And Pale Horse explores that. You know, he starts out a respectable small businessman, happily married. Within 6 seconds of the play, that's no longer the case. And by the end of it, he's kind of face down in the dirt, being arrested in some sort of Wandsworth cemetery, having sort of weird visions, you know, and yabbering and drinking vodka.
If you've been accused of anything on the negative side, it's the dreaded sin of naturalism. Have you any sympathy at all with this kind of criticism?
The sin of naturalism? Yeah, I can understand that criticism. That's fair enough. I think that naturalism can be very boring, you know. I don't think that I do naturalism, though. That's the thing. I think that I do a kind of heightened naturalism. I do a kind of poetic realism, you know, in the sense that Wojtek is a heightened naturalism. It's verging on expressionism. Pale Horse is probably the most expressionistic play, you know. And if I tried to peddle that as naturalism, there would be all these people going, what are you talking about? It's not naturalism. Are you crazy? You know, people don't behave like that. So I don't think that I do write naturalism. Blue Orange is by no stretch of the imagination naturalism. It's fairy tale compared to naturalism. You know, you'd never... It's just not a real situation. Doctors would never spend that much time talking to patients. Most patients don't present with such florid, intriguing dilemmas. There's no such thing as hallucinating oranges as blue. It's just not something that you can do. You know, it's full of invention and metaphor. It's pure. It's pure heightened naturalism. It's poetic realism. It's a take. All my stuff is an expressionistic take on something. It's not researched. And people always ask me if I researched the subject of mental illness. No, I didn't research it. That would be nonsense to research it. I'm inherently suspicious of people that decide they're going to write about a subject and then go and research it in Earlsfield Library or whatever. You know, it's bogus. And if anything, the criticism of my work should be that it's made up, it's invented, it's not journalistic, and it's not this pithy kind of naturalism. It's poetry. Sometimes it's bad poetry, but it's not naturalism.
Last year, you dramatised The Long Firm, Jake Arnott's book about London gangland in the 1960s. I think that was for the BBC. Mm-hmm. How did that project come about?
That came about because Liza Marshall, who produced it at the BBC, just sent me the book one day in about 1999, I think, and said, what do you think? Do you want to adapt it? And I read it, just liked it instantly, you know. I liked his voice, the Jake Arnott's voice. It seemed similar to my voice. It's inherently, what's going on there is inherently political, and it has a kind of wider social significance. But time and time again, what he's studying is the idiosyncrasy of individual character. All these characters are quirky and peculiar and idiosyncratic and yet somehow universal, and they all embody huge paradoxes. You know, I'm really interested in contradiction and paradox and ambiguity, and Harry Starks is a gay, Jewish, extremely tough, violent, hard gangster who really wants to run a nightclub with people like Judy Garland singing. You know, he wants to be Brian Epstein. And I love that paradox, because I think people are inherently paradoxical, and all the characters in it are full of paradox and myth. You know, it's very mythological, and I'm as interested as anybody in the myths of the 60s, and he sort of unpacks them. And, you know, each story, each of the five stories, has something that on a personal level really fascinates me. You know, there's the violence, which I've always sort of made one of my special interests. There's the showbiz thing, which I've always been interested in. You know, exactly. You know, everybody's a ham underneath. Then you've got this lovely chapter at the end where it's all about the anti-psychiatry movement and anti-structuralism. And you know, it's, to all intents and purposes, not a billion miles away from Blue Orange. So, and then you've got all this kind of dark working class London iconography, which is the kind of thing that I was interested in when I did Pale Horse. You know, people that would come out of Parkhurst and now amongst us. So it just seemed to me like it was up my street, you know.
Your last play at the Court, Dumb Show, I read some quite hostile reviews of that. What do you think that the critics missed with that show?
I don't know. I don't know what to make of those reviews, because I read a lot of good reviews and I read a couple of raves and I read a couple of stinkers. So I never... So what do you concentrate on? Do you think about the raves or do you think about the stinkers or what do you think about? But I suppose the stinkers I asked for... Because you don't pick a fight with the press and get away without a few bruises. And the raves I obviously enjoyed. I suppose there was a lot of reviews that said the bleeding obvious, which is that there's nothing particularly complicated about tabloid morality. That doesn't mean I have no right to write a play about it. You know, because it's not as complex and enigmatic as the subject of schizophrenia, it doesn't mean that I can't write a play about it. I know better than anybody that schizophrenia and the story of Ray and the story of Christopher are just hand-tooled, you know, theatre nectar, you know. They're going to get people excited intellectually and emotionally. They just are. The story, that's a found story. That subject is, anybody that engages with that subject is going to find it incredibly rich. The thing about the tabloids is it's endlessly, bottomlessly banal. And so the play had to be banal, you know. It would have been a nonsense to suddenly start poking about and investigating the issues associated with investigative journalism or anything like that. And one or two of the reviews said that, you know, there's nothing about the serious issues of investigative journalism. Or that's because there is no issues. Don't kid yourselves. You know, there is no issues. And a lot of people would like to be edified when they go to the theatre. Sometimes there are some subjects which are not edifying subjects. And I think that some people found the play a bit kind of grubby and simplistic. And it's a grubby, simplistic subject, and it's banal, and it's also hugely popular. It has this country by the throat, tabloid, celebrity, morality, and culture. So, you know, I don't really mind any of those reviews. They're entitled to their opinion, but I'm disappointed that they're disappointed that they weren't edified. You know, it's not my job to edify you or teach you something you don't know. You know, there's the World Wide Web, there's enormous libraries everywhere. If you want to be educated, go and educate yourself. Don't expect a playwright to educate you, you know.
But as well as being entertaining and funny, the play, and also obviously a critique of celebrity culture and so on, the play was also about language, I thought. It was your Harold Pinter play, in that people talked, but they talked not... always to communicate, often to evade communication. Is that right?
Yeah, it's about the impoverishment of language now and the impoverishment of tabloid language, which is increasingly part of the lexicon of sort of living people. And increasingly on television, you know, the reality TV shows, everybody is speaking this bizarre language, monosyllables and cadence. And that was the hard thing about writing the play, was that I knew that the language was impoverished. The language is nowhere near as rich as the language in Blue Orange, because Blue Orange, you're writing about sophisticated, well-educated, extraordinary people. You know, Robert is a disciple of Allen Ginsberg. You know, come on, he's gonna have an interesting turn of phrase. If my journalist characters had this extraordinarily poetic, interesting turn of phrase, the journalists that write about it might like to think that that's how they think and speak, but it's not the truth. It would be nonsense. What appalls me about those characters and appalled me about the people that they're based on is that they are that banal, and they have got the media by the throat. So it was an unpleasant play in some ways to write, in that it was about endlessly banal people with no kind of moral framework whatsoever, this terrible piety. And I, going back to your previous question, what disappointed me about the critics is that a lot of them said, I can't believe that these journalists are so vacuous and so disingenuous. Well, they are. They just are. It's like a play about the Nazis going, well, I can't believe the Nazis were that bad. They were. So just get over it, you know? And, Yeah, it's a weird one, that one. Because normally with my plays, I write about characters that I like or are interested in. With that play, I was writing about characters that sort of fascinated me for all sorts of dubious reasons. But I couldn't say that I liked them.
And yet it, as well as being entertaining, it has your kind of brand of moral conviction quite strongly, as does Blue Orange. How conscious are you of that kind of strong sense of right and wrong that goes through your writing?
Not really conscious of it until now, really. Now I'm becoming conscious of it, and it's a bit of an albatross, really, you know. It became an albatross with Dumb Show, because I realised that people had seen Blue Orange and were expecting this to be a kind of dissertation on the media, in the same way that Blue Orange was perceived as a dissertation on the NHS. And it was perceived to have this sort of moral fire burning underneath it. And although, you know, I'm grateful that people found that to a certain extent satisfying and intriguing, that I was getting so crazed about the tabloids, I wasn't. And there isn't any kind of moral indignation in that play. I find that subject endlessly strange and funny and intriguing and repulsive and all sorts of things, but I'm not for one second, you know, protesting or trying to change anything or illustrate anything. I'm just examining a weird kind of extremely pervasive sort of phenomenon, you know. So I don't know, but it's becoming an albatross, yeah, because now I feel that I have this responsibility to sort of blast out these missives from the fringe, you know, spokesman for the disenfranchised, you know, always with something rather kind and morally right on and fiery and, you know, from the pulpit. And I'm not like that at all. I don't think like that. I don't like those kind of plays, you know. Maybe Death of a Salesman, seeing Death of a Salesman at a very early age, had this kind of subliminal effect on me, which I've never quite escaped from. But I don't know. I'm in a weird place at the moment, really, in terms of what to do for the theatre next, because there's going to be baggage, whatever happens next. You know, there's going to be this assumption that... I think Dumb Show, because for my money, Dumb Show was a big success, and I really enjoyed it. But it did. It was the you know, people brought their assumptions to it, and it's like it's my Speed the Plow. You know, it's my little short 90-minute laugh fest. You know, that's it. There's nothing of any import there. If I wanted to go to town on the media, you know, and newspapers, I would really go to town on them. But that wasn't the point. That was really poking fun at showbiz, because I've been immersed in it for the last 4 years. You know, I've been up to my neck in it, celebrities and cameras and stuff.
Great. Thanks, Joe Penhall. Thanks for talking to Theatre Voice. All the best with Blue Orange, which is at the Crucible in Sheffield till the end of February.